I'm delighted that we've got Professor Tiffany Stern, Professor of Early Modern Drama at Oxford University, to speak to us about something that's got a bit of knowledge transfer in it as well, I suppose you could say. Stuck up and down about the city, playbills in Shakespeare's London. Tiffany.
Thank you very much. Can I just check that everyone can hear me? Yeah. Okay, good. Good. So I'm going to talk about playbills in early modern London. Playbills are, of course, advertisements. So I'm going to be talking about the way that theatre was advertised. My talk will have three parts. First, I'll look at why playbills were necessary and why we should be interested in them. Secondly, I'll raise an enormous problem. And thirdly, I'll try to solve the problem. So to start with, why playbills were necessary. I'm going to start with a very boring slide, but I'll explain why I'm showing this to you. This slide is a bit of what we call a diary, but it's not really a diary. It's actually Philip Henslowe's financial accounts for the Rose Theatre. And what you can see from these financial accounts for plays put on in 1594 is that a different play was put on every day. In early modern London, there wasn't a play run. And this is because London was so tiny that it couldn't really sustain an audience for a repeated run of the same play all the time. So there were different plays put on every day. And you can see from this list here, if you look to the left a little, you can see this repeated word, ne, that's for new. There's a new play added every fortnight or so, together with a huge range. In a season, you might end up performing 40 different plays. Well, there are a lot of interesting things to say about that, but one thing that is interesting is how on earth would the audience know what play was going to be on? You don't want to turn up to the theatre and find yourself about to see the same play you saw last week. So you're going to need some... we talked a little bit earlier about knowledge transfer. You're going to need knowledge about what plays are being put on. And another reason why you really need to know this, here's a picture of early modern London. On the far end, there's St. Paul's in the middle. That's early modern London. And you can see it's a big conurbation. That's where most people live. And then you can see London Bridge. You can see the traitors' heads hanging above London Bridge on this side of the Thames. And then along the bottom on this side, you can see Southwark Cathedral and two theatres with their flags flying. Theatres would fly their flags when they were about to put on a play. But looking here, you can see that most people live in London. They don't live so much on this side of the Thames. And this is another reason why it's going to be very important to know what plays are on. You don't want to cross the Thames and then in order to go to the theatre and then find there's nothing you want to see. Not least because crossing the Thames costs money. You have to pay to go onto London Bridge, a toll, or you have to pay a ferryman, a boatman, to carry you over the Thames. So it's very, very important that you have a sense of what plays are on. So, well, how would you find out what plays are on? There's a series of ways. One is this. Pontus comes posting almost every day and cries, "How do you, sir? Come, what's the play?" So one thing you can do is ask. You can ask around. Of course, the person you're asking has to have the knowledge. So that's not the ideal way to find out. Posting here means hurrying. I mentioned that because the word will come to be repeatedly useful to us in this talk. So how else might you find out what the play is for that day? Here is a furious sermon which tells us something about another way. "Will not a filthy play with the blast of a trumpet sooner call thither 1,000 than an hour's tolling of a bell bring to the sermon 100. So what this tells us is that plays were what was called cried. That is to say that the players would go out into London with their trumpet and their drum, and they'd toot the trumpet and they'd bang the drum, and they would tell you what that day's play was. So they would cry the play. And they continued when they travelled to cry plays. It's sometimes thought that maybe they stopped crying the plays in London in the 1610s or so, when they became more sophisticated. I'm not sure that that's really the case. I think they went on crying them. So you can ask people, oh, the play will be cried, but you can see problems with that. Suppose you weren't in the street where the play was cried, or you were in the street but not at the time when the players were passing through. It's a poor way to get that information out and about. So that's a little bit useful, but not fully useful. Here's another way of finding out what the day's play is, and that is that at the end of one performance, the next day's play would be announced. So this is something that happens in the theatre. After the epilogue, there comes someone to tell spectators what shall next be shown. Well, that's fine if you're at the playhouse, but suppose you weren't at the playhouse. And anyway, this very event, announcing after the epilogue, can lead to problems of its own. As we'll see here, this is a story, this is a translation from an Italian who came to England. At the end of the performance, he invited the public to the play for the next day and named one. But the people who wanted a different one began to call out because they wanted one that they called Friars. So what has happened here is that after the epilogue, one play has been announced, but the people present in the theatre are demanding a different play. Now, if that play is going to be changed overnight, now this makes it extremely crucial that tomorrow you get correct knowledge of what play is going to be on. So you can see where all this is leading up to. There are other ways of finding out what plays are going to be put on tomorrow, but it's really, really crucial that playbills be released, that adverts be released and scattered over London, because that's going to be the best way to get the knowledge to the largest number of people. So I said I was going to explain why we might be interested in these. Having said that these playbills are going to be scattered all over London, London itself had rejected theatres. That's why we keep seeing them in Southwark, which was outside London at that time. So it's going to be interesting if a little bit of a memory of a play in print form is going to get itself scattered around London where plays themselves can't be. So that's fascinating. So we'd also like to know, well, where were these playbills hung? Were there places you knew to look? And what were they hung with? What was their sort of context? And how many of them were there? Did everyone know about plays, or only people who wanted to know about plays knew about plays? So lots and lots of questions. And we'd also like to know about the content of playbills. What was it that sold a play? Did you want to know the name of the theatre, the names of the actors? Did a playwright's name, would Shakespeare, would that sell a play? How did plays, what was their advertising language like? Did they tell any bit of their story? So these are all things that you can see are very interesting, the content of playbills and the context of playbills. So having said all of that, you might imagine that we would all be studying the playbills all the time, studying them and thinking about them and comparing them to play texts. And we don't do that at all. And the reason why is the big problem that I said I was going to raise with you. And the big problem is that no playbills survive from the early modern period. So you can all go home now, that's the end. I said I was going to try to solve that problem in some way. Although no playbills survive, there are bills for other things that survive, which can give us a sense of how playbills may have looked and the kinds of things they might have told us. And then there are other bits of information that can also give us an idea of what numbers were the bills printed in, where were they hung, what was their content, and so forth. So the rest of this talk will be something a little bit like a kind of detective novel. I'm going to try to find out by one remove what playbills were like. And as with detective novels, I'm going to try to have a kind of surprise at the end. Okay, so these lost playbills. One thing we can know is who printed the playbills, because only one printer at any time in England was allowed to print the playbills. So we can trace through printers' records who were the playbill printers. And the first one we know about was John Charlwood, who was made printer for all manner of bills for players. But that's actually rather interesting. If only one printer can print all the bills, that means all those competing companies have to be advertised by the same guy. And that also means all those competing theatre companies have to turn up at the same printers. And it's not a surprise to find that the playbill printers end up being printers of playbooks very often, because they've got a special relationship with theatre companies. So John Charlwood was the first playbill printer. And then he died, and James Roberts, a fellow printer, married his wife, Charlwood's wife. And James Roberts, that means inherited Charlwood's types. And he also inherited from that process the right to print the bills for players. But this is also interesting. This tells us that over time, the playbills must have looked relatively similar over time, because they're being printed, although by different people. There's a line of inheritance, and the pieces of type and the ornaments will be inherited. And James Roberts printed an awful lot of Shakespeare quartos. And William Jaggard, who started sharing a premises with James Roberts and then took it over when James Roberts died, William Jaggard became the next playbill printer. So you can see that a lot of this is to do with inheritance. And it's possible you've heard of William Jaggard because he is the person who printed Shakespeare's first folio with his son Isaac. So as I say, these are people with a particular connection to players, because those players have to go to their establishments all the time for the playbill to get their playbills printed. And then finally, Jaggard died, and all his types and ornaments and his establishment was purchased by Thomas and Richard Coates, and they became the playbill printers. And there are only these four playbill printers with a direct line of inheritance before it's the English Civil War and all theatres are closed. So, as I say, this tells us rather interesting things about the very close connection that the different theatre companies must have had. And we often imagine that theatre companies didn't like printers. But actually, we can see here that theatre companies are very reliant on printers for their advertising. And that also makes us realise that most people met a play, if they were going to meet it in a playbill in an advert, most people met a play in print first. Even if the whole play itself was never printed, they met it as a printed advert first, and then as a performance second. There's even a little bit of history to do with a strange quarrel that Jaggard had with Roberts. Firstly, Jaggard was really keen to print playbills, and when Charlwood died, Jaggard tried to acquire the printing of the bills for players that John Charlwood had had. And the reason why Jaggard and everyone will have been really interested in being a playbill printer was that if you're a printer-publisher, you're usually printing books, and then you only get money for them if people buy the books. And if they don't buy the books, you've lost out on a lot of money. So you're always gambling. But the wonderful thing about printing playbills is it's not reliant on sales for you. You just print the bills, you are paid for doing that, and you don't care if anyone went to the play or not. So that's why you really want to be a bill printer if you can, because that's safe money. And we can even learn a little bit that might help us work out quite how much money it is. Because Jaggard was so keen to be a playbill printer that he started illegitimately printing playbills when it was still James Roberts's right. And James Roberts and he finally came to an agreement. So Jaggard had been printing bills illegally for Worcester's men, so for one acting company. And eventually Roberts let him. The said William Jagger shall have the only and sole imprinting of the said bills for the said company of players, now appertaining or hereafter to appertain to the said Earl of Worcester. The said William, yielding and printing therefore to the said James Roberts and his said wife, or one of them, monthly 4 shillings. And the said William Jagger to meddle with the printing of no other bills for players but these only. So William Jaggard is prepared to pay 4 shillings a month to be allowed to print the bills. So he must make more than 4 shillings a month for printing bills for one company. Let's say then he makes 6 shillings a month for printing the bills. Well, there are usually 6 companies in London. So if, as bill printer, you would hope to get 6 times 6 shillings a month, you're going to get at least £3 a year for printing bills. And that's really a lot of money if you think that you can get into the Globe for 1 penny and you can buy a loaf of bread for 1 penny. So £3 is really great. So this is why you want to be the playbill printer. So even though we don't have the bills, we know a little bit about their printers. We also know a little bit about adverts in London more generally. People often exaggerate something I'm going to come back to. They often exaggerate how few people could read. Quite a lot of people could read, but I'll talk a little later on about strange halfway points between reading and not reading. And because people don't think about this, they don't have a sense of quite how full of adverts, both manuscript and print, London was. But it's actually really, really, really full of advertisements everywhere, a bit like London now. And here, this is just a standard advert. They don't tend to survive over time, which is why we don't have a sense of them. This is an advert for a most excellent offer of a certain invention for a new kind of fire being both cheap and good. There are 2 pictures of the new kind of fire. And underneath, there's a lot of text. These days we would have 3 bullet points about why the fire is so great, but this is an earlier point in the history of advertising. Probably, I'm not quite sure who the printer TC is, but I suspect it's Thomas Coates. So I think he's getting a bit of a market in printing single sheets on one side. We also have some adverts for other things that aren't quite playbills, but are very close to them. This is maybe the closest, and it's also printed by Thomas Coates. And this is an advert for rope dancers. I'm going to read it to you. It's an advert for rope dancers. Rope dancers are essentially tightrope walkers. And these are rope dancers who are going to perform. They're obviously touring rope dancers, and so they're going to perform around England. And I'm just going to read this to you so that you can get a sense of advertising language. But also, this gives you an idea of what a rope dancing bill, and so a playbill, might have looked like. Firstly, if you're sensible, and if you're repeatedly going to do the same show, you have a gap for changeable information. So if you look at the top here, it says, at the. And then in manuscript, it says, Rose in Wine Street. So at the, and then you can you leave a gap for the changing place. That's how we can tell these must be touring rope dancers. The Rose in Wine Street was a theatre in Bristol. And it says above it, at 9 o'clock, because they've forgotten to put a gap for you to put the time in. At the Rose in Wine Street, this present day, and that's also interesting, this present day means that this bill only works today. Tomorrow it will be wrong. So this is a one-day bill that's printed. At the Rose, this present day shall be shown rare dancing on the ropes, acted by His Majesty's servants, wherein an Irish boy of 8 years old doth vault on the high rope, the like was never seen, and one maid of 15 years of age and another girl of 4 years of age do dance on the low rope. And the said girl of 4 years of age doth turn on the stage and put in 4 score threads into the eye of an needle. And other rare activities of body, as vaulting and tumbling on the stage and eggs dancing upon a staff, with other rare varieties of dancing, the like hath not been seen in the realm of England. And the merry conceits of Jack Pudding. If God permit, vivat rex. Why it's amazing to see a four-year-old putting 80 threads into a needle, I don't quite know, on a rope. But anyway, this is a very strange advert, but it's printed by Thomas Coates, the Playbill printer. And as I say, it gives us a sense of, amongst other things, advertising language. The like was never seen. The like hath not been seen in the realm of England. Now, who will have written this copy here? Obviously, it won't have been written by the bill printer. He doesn't know what the rope dancers do. It must have been written by one of the rope dancers, someone who really knows their show and is trying to promote it. This will come to be important when we consider who wrote playbills. There are other interesting things about here. It ends with the words, Vivat Rex, long live the king. And we'll see that all adverts for entertainments end with Vivat Rex. That means that all entertainments sort of look in bill form a bit like one another. You can tell what it is. And it also means, ending on long live the king, that's how you show that you're allowed and you're not subversive and that you're kind of moral and patriotic and all those things. So there we have a rope dancing advert. Here's another advert that survives. And this is for something that happens in a theatre. So that is particularly, this is maybe the nearest then we have, or like the bill before, very near to a playbill. Theatres weren't only used for putting on plays, and it's strange how little we address the other things that were put on in theatres. But very often theatres were rented out for challenges of one kind or another, and this is a challenge that two soldiers are having with one another to fight on the stage of the Red Bull. So again, I'll read some of it to you. So it's a challenge from Richard Gravener, gentleman. And he says, if we look at the middle bit, this is his challenge. And again, you can see that the content of this bill is clearly written by him, Richard Gravener. And once again, this is also a bill for a one-day performance. If we look, it says from Richard Gravener, and if you look sort of at the bottom of that paragraph, it says, this to be performed at the Red Bull in St. John Street, that's the Red Bull Theatre, on Tuesday next. So whereas the last bill was a one-day bill for this present day, this is a long-term bill for next week, on Tuesday next, being the 20th of October, 1629. And this is Robert Gravener's challenge. And I'll read it to you. It's a bit chatty. As ever, they're still working out advertisement language. So he says, judicious gentlemen and others, I being a soldier, from me expect no complimental phrases, for in my opinion, that more stuffs the ear than please the eye. Then to leave off this empty outside of verbal threatenings, I, in plain terms, challenge Thomas Bloon at these 8 several weapons here under named. Desiring from the spectator's stage room and from him his uttermost of his malice. And then he names the eight weapons: long pick, black sword, single rapier, sword and dagger, half pick, sword and butler, rapier and dagger, halberd. And at the very end, Vivat Rex again. So once again, this bill looks like the rope dancing bill, and also looks like the playbills. They all end with Vivat Rex. And here, this challenge, which is to be put on in a theatre, is again written by the challenger, by the person who's going to perform that activity in his rather chatty way. Here is another bill. This is a manuscript bill. And it's a bill, and I don't quite know why it's manuscript. Possibly this is the copy for print. But possibly because this is some rather poor people from Essex who are bringing their Essex bear to London, also for a challenge. Maybe they haven't the money to print these bills and they're having to handwrite them all. So I'm going to tell you what the gamesters of Essex are going to do with their special Essex bear. And the bill begins tomorrow. So this is a tomorrow bill. That means when it is tomorrow, you need to have new bills saying today. Okay, tomorrow being Thursday, and then it says above A, because they haven't got their spacing very well. Tomorrow being Thursday, shall be seen at the Bear Garden on the Bankside a great match played by the gamesters of Essex, who hath challenged all comers whatsoever to play five dogs at the single bear for £5. That is to say, you are to bring your dogs, and it's a challenge, their bear and your dogs. And also, to weary a bull dead at the stake, so that's bull baiting, and for your better content shall be pleasant sport with the horse and ape, and whipping of the blind bear. Vivat Rex. So, I think we're now getting a sense of the look of these things, the amount of content they have. It can be quite chatty, the way they end with Vivat Rex, the way they are written by the people themselves who are going to perform this feat, and the kind of advertising language they might try to use. We also have the odd bills that survive from other countries. This is a French bill. In the middle, there's a gap for the changeable information, as with the rope dancing bill. This is a German bill, so I'm not going to concentrate on those. But we have seen that that these bills are odd. We have next week bill, tomorrow bills, today bills, and that must mean that people have to be rebilling the same event all the time, unless they're using one of those bills with the gap with changeable information. So one question we must have is, how many of those bills were printed and who posted them? Well, to explain this, I'm going to tell you a little bit about John Taylor. John Taylor, you may have heard of him. He's sometimes called John Taylor, the water poet. I showed you that picture of the Thames and mentioned those ferrymen. John Taylor was one such man whose job... So he was essentially a taxi driver of those days. His job was to ferry people across the Thames. But he prided himself in also being a poet. And he published lots and lots of his poetry, and he liked to compare himself with Ben Jonson quite a lot. Now, poor Taylor, he advertised a challenge. We've seen that the bear challenge, and we've seen that fighting challenge. He had a challenge, a poetry challenge, with William Fenner, a fellow poet, and they were both to turn up at the Hope Theatre on stage and have an extempore poetic battle. And William Fenner agreed to this and then didn't turn up. And that left poor John Taylor alone on stage. And everyone threw things at him and he was very upset. And this is a furious response he publishes to William Fenner, asking Fenner why he didn't turn up, and saying how awful it was that Fenner didn't show up for the battle. And so here he is, very indignant. "When such a fellow with me shall agree, and take my money for an earnest fee, and make me print 1,000 bills and more, and daily on the posts to clap up store for 1,000 readers as they pass the way, to see my name engaged to play a play against William Fenner, when he'll do all that and not turn up, outrageous." So he says he printed bills. B, he says there were over 1,000 of them. And C, he says he himself had to put the bills up, clap them up. Now, he's probably exaggerating when he says 1,000. But from this, we can gather that when people got bills printed, they tended to get a lot printed. And of course, that makes sense. Once you've paid for the type to be set up, you might as well print more. Other people who had challenges, and this is how we're finding out something about numbers of playbills, they include the Silver Brothers, who were brothers who were fighters and who challenged some Italian fighters. And here we have a little bit on the challenge that they made. "My brother Toby Silver and myself made challenge against the two Italians. We caused to that effect 50 or 60 bills of challenge to be printed and set up from Southwark to the Tower and from thence through London unto Westminster. So 20, so 50 or 60 is 100 to 120 bills. That may be more reasonable than Fenner's 1,000, than Taylor's 1,000 bills. But it says at least over 100. And they're also naming the way that they scattered them all over London. So London is full of adverts for entertainments. And indeed, players have to publish in these kinds of numbers, presumably somewhere upwards from 100 to 1,000, because these adverts are crucial. Upon a little abatement of the plague, even in the first week of Lent, the players set up their bills and began to play in the Blackfriars and other houses. Here we have a play where Belsh enters setting up bills, and a captain comes to him. "Sirrah, what set you up there?" "Text bills for plays." So these, as you can see from the first quotation, the players themselves are doing their own bill posting. And here, this in this play, Historio Mastix, Belsh is a player, and he is setting up one of their playbills. So they seem to have to do their own advertising. "Were our bills posted, that our house may be with numerous auditory stored?" So you're really relying, the playing companies are very reliant on these bills, on these large numbers of bills. That means you're going to have to post playbills quite early. At 9 o'clock, this is 9 a.m, these are things that happen at 9 o'clock. One is the crier tries the strength of his throat, and another is that the players' bills are almost all set up. So here we have one of the morning activities for the players. Presumably, if you want those many bills scattered all over London, most of you have to have a handful, and you've probably got your area, and you have to go in and bill post, and that's one of your morning routines. That means that these bills are all over the place, but where precisely are they stuck? Well, you've heard this word post. People keep talking about posting the bills. If you think of our current advertisements now, we often call them posters. Posters. And this all comes from the same thing, from the fact that bills were stuck on posts. Bills were stuck on posts. We therefore got the verb to post a bill, and we got the noun poster, a thing that is stuck onto a post. This led to jokes. I'm afraid early modern jokes are not usually hilarious. But here is an early modern joke to do with, and this is to do with a pun between a post in the street and also post meaning fast. "Master Field, the player," this is Nathan Field, an actor, "Master Field, the player, riding up Fleet Street a great pace, a gentleman called him, and asked him what play was played that day. He, being angry to be stayed upon so frivolous a demand, answered that he might see what play was to be played upon every post. "I cry you mercy," said the gentleman. "I took you for a post, you rode so fast." But what this says is that these playbills are on all the posts of London. All the posts, you can see them everywhere. And that makes us have to ask, well, what are all these posts? Why is London full of posts? Well, if you think about it, a lot of people have horses, and you're going to need to tether your horses. So just as London now is full of bicycle racks, so London then was full of posts for tethering. But there were lots and lots of other kinds of posts as well. And I'll come to those in a second. I just want to talk here about the effect that all these posted bills could have. I talked about the way London was full of adverts for something that London didn't allow, the theatre. And this is why this is a terrible thing that could happen if you read a bill. Here's a man who will to a sermon go, where, by the way, a bill he doth espy, which shows there's acted some new comedy. Then thither is he full and wholly bent. There's nothing that shall hinder his intent. So here's a man who was going to go to a sermon, a good thing, but then he saw a bill for a comedy and now he's going to go to the theatre instead. And this is the kind of thing that makes Puritans really hate, not just, well, I mean, they maybe hate theatres more because even their very playbills are corrupting people. And because the fact that there are playbills all over London remind them of that terrible theatre. So the theatre can corrupt people well away from the stage through the medium of playbills, as happened with this man. Okay, posts. This is one kind of post. This is John Taylor, the water poet, again. John Taylor took a trip to Scotland, and he was imitating Ben Jonson's trip to Scotland. And he advertised that he would write lots of poems and interesting things about his amazing trip abroad to Scotland when he returned, and a lot of people said they would subscribe to his book. And then when he came back, they didn't subscribe. After all, he didn't get the money he thought he would for his Scottish trip. And this is what he says in his rage. He says, "I swear by sweet Sir Tarik Nash, his urn, on every pissing post their names I'll place." So pissing post is another kind of post in early modern London. As you can imagine, it is a post around which gentlemen can pee. It's a kind of urinal post. And as with modern day urinals, it's quite normal to stick things up there for people to read while they're peeing. And yet it's a kind of, it's a place which obviously if you put things on a pissing post, that often downgrades the very thing you've put there. And this is what John Taylor tends to do. So that also tells us that there was a hierarchy of space in London, that different bits of space would be read differently. And it's important what kind of space bills would be placed in. There's also a post that's carved to the common street for every scurril wit to pin disgrace and libels on it. So this is a carved post that that libels are pinned onto. What I imagine then is the case is I suspect this tells us that there were in fact advertisement posts for ads and for libels and things, that there are posts for information to be pinned on. And although we don't have them in England, in France and other continental countries, there are often those big kind of round pillar-like things for adverts, sort of big fat posts for adverts. And I think this carved post here is an advert post. And there seem to be obvious places where one might post information. This is reference to a libel set up in all famous places of the city, as Queenhithe, Newgate, the Stocks, Pillory, Pissing Conduit, Bridewell. So there are clearly particular spaces where you might particularly look for adverts, both particular spaces in London and also particular varieties of post where you might expect to get that information. So now we have a bit of a better sense of where we might find those things. A very, very obvious place to find playbills is obviously at your theatre. The theatre will certainly advertise what's going on. Here's poor Richard Flecknoe. He is sad. This is in the 1650s. All the theatres have been closed, and he's nostalgic. And he passes by Blackfriars, which was the theatre in which that Shakespeare's company started using from 1609. And he passes by Blackfriars and sees never a playbill on the gate. No coaches on the place, nor doorkeeper. So this is sad. And here's a French picture. It's a French picture, but it shows a playhouse door, and you can see flanking the door two adverts in large writing. So not very much information, but saying who the performers are and presumably what the play is. Another place you would hang adverts is, of course, houses. Here are pictures. These are people in Holland, and they are hanging libels on people's houses. But we certainly get the sense that from things like this precept that bills were on houses as well as other places. This says, it gives the charge to all the inhabitants within the ward that they do not suffer any person to set up or fix any papers upon any posts, houses, or other places for the show of any plays. So this says that these bills are all over the place, and if they're on your house and you're an inhabitant, well, you should stop that happening, and presumably you should pull them down from your house. And indeed, people did pull them down. But once you pull down a bill, you're actually very likely to take it indoors. So those bills start getting not only over all the streets of London, but they get into the houses of London. And that means we probably have a mixture in London of bills and also things that are a bit more like flyers. Because here are references to people taking stuff off posts in order to bring them in the house and think about them a bit more. Here's someone who has a playbill severed from the post to inform you what's to play. And it was normal for people thinking of going to the theatre to send their servants down and gather up the playbills. Here's a woman who makes pleasure her vocation. That's to say, a not very admirable woman. The playbills must be bought her by her pensioner. Her eye views and reviews, and out of her feminine judgment, culls one out from among them, which she will see. So she has sent someone to gather all the playbills. This is a gentleman usher. That's to say, a rather upper-class servant. It's his element to be versed in the perusal of playbills, which he presents to his lady with great devotion and recommends some especial one to her view, graced by his own judicious approbation. His choice she admits, to the playhouse she resorts. So this is another thing about those terrible playbills. They've worked their way into the houses. Now they've made the servant and the lady very close, kind of flirtatiously close. He, the servant, is advising the lady. Then they go together to the playhouse and they sort of play footsie together, and it's all terrible, and it's all to do with these playbills. So the playbills are, in a sense, more awful than the plays. They are so corrupting, they're so bad. And plays, of course, stage this also. Art thou sure the play is played today? Oh, here's the bill, sir. And then we've got a stage direction. He gives him the playbill. So they're staging the way they are advertised. Those silver brothers, the people who challenged the Italians didn't want to know they'd been challenged very much. So helpful gentlemen of good account carried many of the bills of challenge unto them, telling them that now the silvers were at the place appointed with all their weapons looking for them. So this is how... if you are being challenged, it's a bit hard to escape the playbills. So they travel around very fast. That's probably why you need to rebill all the time. Those things are getting pulled down. Then you have to rescatter them over London. And that's probably why we hear about flying papers, which cannot abide the pasting to posts. Though pasting is interesting. Pasting suggests that at least some adverts you stick up with paste, probably flour and water. So some are stuck up and are meant to stay there a bit. And in fact, there's a kind of hierarchy of things that are pasted and things that are not. If it be a proclamation, that is pasted unto the wall. If it be a new pamphlet, that is fastened to the wall with nails. Now, as I said, some of these bills seem to be a bit fixed and some seem to be more like flyers. So you probably have some which are pasted and some which are hung with nails of those playbills. As I say, I just want you to get a sense of how extremely papery London was and how filled it was with the things it was worried about, playbills. So another question is, what is the context of those bills? We've talked about the places they might hang, but what might they hang with? Because that's going to tell us something about how they rank. Here's a bit of a dictionary which glosses the French word placard by this. It says, a bill, sequis, or libel stuck upon a post, etc. So bills seem to be stuck with libels. They seem to rank with libels and also with sequices. And you may wonder, what is a sequis? It comes from the Latin, sequis, if anyone. And a sequis was their name for an advertisement. Because an advertisement characteristically began, if anyone, you know, if anyone wants a new hat, he is to come to, and that's how your advertisement goes. And in fact, this third example shows a sequis. What sequis is that? This is from a play. I'll read it, sir. If there be any gentleman, so that's the sequis. If there be any gentleman that for the accomplishing of his natural endowments entertains the desire of learning the languages, and then it lists the languages, I'm now going to the bottom. He shall, to his abundant satisfaction, be made happy in his expectation and success if he please to repair to the sign of the globe. So that's a sequis, so it's an advert. So bills hang in the same places as adverts and libels. So you can see that's rather low. They might hang on pissing posts. They might hang with kind of not admirable things. Now, we often think about plays that we have them in a sort of classy bit of our heads, particularly if it's Shakespeare. But for people in early modern London, meeting a bill in the same place where they meet a libel and an advert, the first context in which they meet a play is not a literary context. It is, in fact, a context of amusing, scurrilous, and not very important things. On many a post, I see quacksalvers' bills, like fencers' challenges, to show their skills. These are bills for doctors, for quack doctors. I marvel how the masterless men that set up their bills in pools for services, and such as paste up their papers on every post for arithmetic and writing schools, scape eternity. These are shorthand writers, who have labelled to show their skill and with their bills have besprinkled the posts and walls of the city. So everyone was advertising everything, sprinkling the city with paper. But, as I mentioned, space had a kind of hierarchy, and we can really see it with the story of this particular libel. Stephen Hughes pasted and fixed to a market cross libels against Virgil Plaidel, pasted and fixed them. But then they decided, so they were pasting these libels against the market cross. But then they decided, one of the partners said, it wasn't set up publicly enough. They inquired of some there present, upon which post of the cross the king's proclamations used to be set, and there caused Hughes to paste the said libel on that part of the same cross in open view of the town. So they were going to set up the libel in a normal place for libels, but then they swapped it to put it on the other bit of the same cross that's for the king's proclamations. So you can see that space is very ranked. There's a hierarchy of space. And this is an unusual space, that the proclamations have a completely different space, a high space, whereas libels and playbills have a low-ranking space, even on the same cross. So everyone is reading space the way they're reading geography in early modern London. There are other things, as well as libels, that hung and sequences that hung in the same places as playbills. And this is adverts for books. Because adverts for books, the way you advertised your book is you had more title pages printed for it than the rest of the book, and you hung up those title pages, and those title pages were book adverts. This is Ben Jonson, and he's talking to his bookseller about his book, and he doesn't want it to be advertised by title page. To my bookseller, I crave it, my book, lie upon thy stall till it be bought, not offered, as it made suit to be bought, nor have my title leaf on posts or walls or in cleft sticks advanced to make calls for termers or some clerk-like serving men who scarce can spell the hard names. So he's a snob. He doesn't want his title leaf being fingered by people who can't really read properly. You know, he thinks he's more classy than that. This is interesting. The posts and walls that have the playbills also have the advertisements for books. A number of you there be who piteously torment title pages on every post, never reading further of any book than imprinted by Simeon such a sign. Well, if you don't read further than who printed the book, the advert has worked because now you know where you can go to buy it. Here's someone else also talking to his bookseller, and he is making the same request as Ben Jonson. This is Robert Heath. To my bookseller, I have common made my book, 'tis very true, but I'd not have thee post it on each wall and corner post close underneath the play that must be acted at Blackfriars that day. So this tells us something very interesting about context, that the context of playbills might well be directly under a book bill. Playbill and book bill are in entirely the same space, but these people think their books are cheapened by being so advertised. Well then, and yes, there could be great disasters that happened as a result. I have seen a lackey that could not read, having been sent to take down the play for the afternoon, has by mistake brought away the title of a new book of theology. So, this shows us how alike book bills, and which are title pages, and play bills looked, that this person who can't read couldn't tell the difference. Well, so I said that though we don't have play bills, I wanted to have a kind of surprise at the end. And I think the thing is that if playbills look like book bills, then book bills that are four plays, four printed plays, presumably look very much like playbills. So title pages for plays presumably can give us something that gets us near the lost information that was on playbills. And I'll give you some examples that might help to solidify that idea. So firstly, something about playbills, and secondly, something about playbook title pages. So here's some more information about players' bills. The players' bills are set up in sundry places of the city, some in the name of Her Majesty's men, some the Earl of Leicester, some the Earl of Oxford, the Lord Admiral's, and diverse others. So what this tells us is that playbills often named the performing company. And here is a book title page for a pleasant, conceited history called The Taming of a Shrew, as it was sundry times acted by the Right Honourable the Earl of Pembroke, his servants. So that's the same information, the name of the company, and what person owned that company, above the Earl of Leicester, etc., and below the Earl of Pembroke. Now, not Not all playbills are like that. Some name the company, and some instead name the place. A game at chess is advertised on its book title page as it was acted 9 days together at the Globe on the Bankside. So here we have the content of a brief bill, maybe one of these sort of flyer ones. It's part of a law case, that's why we have the content. And it was hung on the White Horse Inn in Norwich. And it said, "Here within this place at 1 o'clock shall be acted an excellent new comedy called The Spanish Contract by the princess's servants, Vivat Rex." So there's the Vivat Rex. And there's a bit of a puff here, a bit of a leer. It's an excellent new comedy. Then it names the comedy. Then it says the company who will perform it. So look at this. This is a book title page for Holland's Liga. "It's an excellent comedy." That's the same advertisement. "As it hath been lately and often acted with great applause by the high and mighty Prince Charles, his servants." So that's the men who'll perform it again at the private house in Salisbury Court. And that's like the naming of the place above. So what I'm going to suggest is that, although I don't think it always happened, I think that sometimes the short flyer version and sometimes the long version of a playbill got handed to a printer with the play itself. So that sometimes I think the title page might preserve that otherwise lost bill, that maybe some of the bills aren't quite as lost as we thought. So here are some more analogies. Again, a reference first to a playbill. This is from Thomas Campion as he publishes some music. He says, "You may find here some 3 or 4 songs that have been published before, but for them I refer you to the player's bill that is styled newly revived with additions." So this is an advert and a player's bill that advertises a play that has been advertised before, but now it's newly revived with additions. It also reminds us why plays were so regularly revised. You have to update them because you're trying to get the same audience to come back and see it again. Here's the title page for the tragical history of the life and death of Dr. Faustus with new additions. So it's that same thing. This is trying to get people to buy the book again who've bought it already, just as the bill above was trying to get people to see it again. So once again, this information is so similar that I think the title page is maybe preserving the lost thing. Now, one big question about those lost playbills is, did they ever name the author of the play? Was it ever important to know that a play was by, for instance, Shakespeare? Well, here are some references to playbills. What pageanter penned that? Wrote that is to say. Who but Master Posthaste? It is as dangerous to read his name at a play door as a printed bill on a plague door. This is because Master Posthaste is a terrible poet. But this at least is a reference to naming a poet on a playbill. A poet is a playwright. And here's an apology for the plot of a play. First, for the plot, it's no way intricate by cross deceits in love, nor so high in state that we might have given out in our playbill this day's The Prince, writ by Nick Machiavell. So these are both references to the fact that you could name authors, and you sometimes named authors in playbills. And I think what we can imagine is that books sometimes name authors and sometimes don't name authors. And basically, I think what we can imagine is something like this. Here is the book title page for Titus Andronicus, and it does not name its author, but it does name the people who acted it. In comparison, here's the title page for Love's Labour's Lost, which says that it is newly corrected and augmented by William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare wasn't named in play title pages until 1598. A lot of his... So in his earlier days, his name didn't work as an advert because no one had heard of him. But in his later days, he got well known and it was worth naming his name amongst other lures to get you to buy his books. And presumably then the same is true of playbills. Basically, you name whatever will help sell your play. And if it's the company, you name that. And if it's the place, you name that. And if it's the author, you'll also name that. But having now said that I think playbills might be preserved in title pages. I want to look at some of the weird chatty title pages we have, and this is information that we often ignore because it's a little bit embarrassing. So here is the title page, 1600 title page, for The Merchant of Venice, written by William Shakespeare. And it says, the most excellent, so there's the lure again, the most excellent history of The Merchant of Venice, with the extreme cruelty of Shylock the Jew towards the said merchant in cutting a just pound of his flesh, and the obtaining of Portia by the choice of three chests, as it hath been divers times acted by the Lord Chamberlain his servants. Okay, well, this is, it's a very reductive summary of the play of Merchant of Venice. And it's also very misleading. The extreme cruelty of Shylock cutting a just pound of his flesh, it doesn't mention here that he doesn't actually do it. It makes it sound like he does do it. And then it adds to that Portia and three chests. So you've got a wicked man, a woman who needs to be acquired by a riddle. And you've got a nice layout here that puts Jew and pound at the end of lines and Portia and three and chests at the end of lines. Well, as a summary of Merchant of Venice, it is really terrible. But as an advertisement, it's not bad. Two gripping things, including cruelty. And my suggestion here is, as we saw, the rope dancing bill was written by the rope dancers, the challenge was written by the challengers. I suspect this terrible bit of text that we never actually, when you buy a Shakespeare, a modern edition, this information, the title page, particularly stuff like that, is usually squirreled away somewhere because, as I say, it's a bit embarrassing. But I do suspect that the writer of copy for playbills and consequently for book title pages like this will have been Shakespeare. There is a very different language for advertising as for writing great plays, and I think your wordsmith would know that. So just one thing that you've probably all been wondering about, and that is that all this, all these references to bills have relied on literate people, and yet we hear that London was full of illiterate people. Well, one thing I want to say is that in these days we have a very clear sense of reading or not being able to read, but there were a lot of intermediate states that you could in fact have. William Davenant's play, The Platonic Lovers, Platonic, says, his title was so hard, above half our city audience knew not how to spell it on the post. That is to say that there are people who spell out words on a post. They're not great readers, but they can just about make up words if they're not really complicated like Platonic. Other people who struggle a bit, fie, granny, fie, to follow bear baitings when you can scarce spell out their bills with spectacles. So spectacles weren't very good in those days, so you would be struggling to read out this information. So there are people who can kind of semi-read. And this leads to another thing, which is that whereas we characteristically, we usually read in our heads, unless, for instance, we're giving a lecture, in those days, you characteristically read out loud. And this is how you would share information. So if you choose to read something, you tend to say it. And then you can gather a little crowd who now have that information because you have read it. So I'm coming very towards the end now. I just wanted to show you this because it has wrongly been called a playbill. It has been said to be our only playbill, but it's not a playbill. You can see it's called the plot of the play called England's Joy. And this is not the earliest playbill, but as it were, a very early theatre programme. This tells you act by act what's going to go on in this amazing play, England's Joy. And in that way, so yet another printed thing made its way into London and into playhouses. Playhouses were very print-reliant, and when you're really trying to promote your play, particularly on a first day, you would often give people a kind of plot summary like this, called a plot or an argument. So this is not a playbill, it's a plot for people in the theatre. In that way, it's a little like this, which, this isn't really apposite, but it's so remarkable I thought I'd show it to you. This is, it's Italian, but it is for an anatomy, for people who are going to go to a theatre and see a dead body being anatomised. And it sort of tells you, kind of scene by scene, which bit of the body you'll get to see next. So it's a complete plan of how it will be, right up to Skeletus, the end, where all the rest of the body has been removed and now you've got a skeleton. And that shows you what a display dead bodies were and how theatrical this business was. This is my very last slide. It's maybe the nearest we've got to a playbill. It does at least involve plays, but it's actually a puppet bill and a very charming one, showing how these advertisements might also be flanked with pictures. So above, we've got what might be the earliest picture of Mr. Punch. This bill is thought to be from maybe the 1650s, during the interregnum when there was no theatre. So there's Mr. Punch, and next to him are Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay and the speaking head from the play of that name. And I'll read it to you. So it's for Bartholomew Fair. It's for a puppet booth in Bartholomew Fair. And it says, John Harris's booth in Bartholomew Fair, between the hospital gate and Duck Lane End, next to the rope dancers, those rope dancers again, is to be seen. The court of King Henry II, and the death of Fair Rosamond, with the merry humours of Punchinello and the Lancashire witches, as also the famous history of Bungay and Friar Bacon, with the merry conceits of their man Miles, and the brazen speaking head, wherein is represented the manner how this kingdom was to have been walled in with brass, acted by figures as large as children 2 years old. And then there's a little manicule, one of these hands. Mistake not the booth. You may know it by the brazen speaking head in the gallery. So it's not quite a playbill, but it is about plays. It's got some of those lures, merry conceits. It shows you again the choice of things to promote. It actually conflates three different plays together. It's got pictures. It's got information as to where you're to go to see this thing. And it once again reminds us how often very, very temporary things, very ephemeral temporary things, were set up in print, because early modern London was in fact totally print reliant. And so although we don't actually have any playbills, I hope you now have a bit of a sense of what they might have been like, where they might have hung with what, and what that therefore means for us today. Thank you.
Well, that was wonderful talk, Tiffany. Thanks so much. It so happens, actually, that the back of our guide, we've got the quarto title page of The Most Excellent History of the Merchant of Venice, etc., with a misleading description of Shylock. And there are several others printed from the collection in the V&A here, in the art collection of quartos, of which there are many, actually. So I was going to ask a question about that, but you've already covered it.
Yes, please.
Well, that was it. It was to do with the fact that it misrepresented the play, and it felt more like an advert than a simple, you know, summary of what was to come.
Yes, I think, I mean, you could see through those various selections of adverts that some people had a better sense of how to advertise than others, and that it's actually something sort of we're more conscious of now, that the less information, the better. You could see early adverts just cramming everything in. But if that is indeed a representation of what the playbill said, which I think it is, it's really good. Two clear points, one wrong. That, you know, the play is excellent. Here are two great reasons why you should go to it.
And do you think it's likely that Shakespeare may have written the text?
Well,
that,
I think someone in the company needs to write it.
Someone.
You know, weirdly, you'll often read quite wrongly that that the title page, because people don't like that kind of thing, and they often say, oh, the silly printer wrote it. You're sort of, the printer doesn't have this information to hand the way the people who play it have it. And as I say, I think it's much more likely to be the play bill. And we've seen from all these other bills that the people who are putting on the entertainment, the challenge or whatever, write their own bills. So someone in the playhouse will have written the copy. And we don't know who it is, but it seems to me your resident playwright is probably the best person to write it. Which would also, of course, mean that any chatty title pages we have to plays by other people, but performed during Shakespeare's lifetime in his company, might also be some more bits and pieces, not very great ones, written by Shakespeare.
And of course, today, authors are always asked to write their own blurb
for
the backs
indeed.
Of their books and so forth, even if a copywriter
Indeed. I was sent something from a publisher saying, you must write your blurb for your book. Here are words you're not allowed to use, groundbreaking, and you're sort of, oh, I wanted to say it was groundbreaking. are there any questions?
Yes, please. Could you say your name? And give us your question.
Hello.
And speak directly into the mic because we want to hear everything on the recording.
James Wallace. I was just, why couldn't it be the, I can understand why it's not the printer, why could it not be the publisher?
Why couldn't what not be the publisher?
Who wrote the
copy? Oh, right, okay. Well, it could be the publisher because they have chosen to purchase the play. One reason I think it's not the publisher is that I partly think it because that title page, for instance, is so wrong. Like I would think that a publisher would be more willing to promote what the play has purchased does do than that thing which weirdly promotes something the play doesn't in fact do. That seems to me one level of kind of tricksy cleverness on that makes me think that it survives from the playbill. And I think what I roughly, the conclusion I was drawing from this is that as what we know about print, about playbills is so clearly represented in book title pages, it seems to me that if you don't have a playbill, you will, of course, then get someone to write copy, and you might, as a publisher, write it, or you might ask someone from the playhouse to write it. But if you do have that, if that is information which travels with the text, as will often have happened, why not just use it again? It's already written. Plays to be published as books have already been advertised as performances. Why change the wording if you get it? So I think, but you are right, that is all speculation. And it was really my attempt to try to make us have something we don't have, which is those lost playbills. But I get the feeling that at least sometimes they are preserved, particularly in the odder and more chatty title pages. Yeah.
Another question, please.
Hi, I'm Paul Arachel. I have a question about the slide that you showed that showed the plot or the argument.
Yes.
Are there others of those that survive? And if not, or even if there are, what other evidence is there that these were not used for advertisement?
Yes, there are quite a lot that survive. They're more usually called arguments. And we have them all scattered all across Europe. They served two different, and well, they served several functions. One was that if actors are performing in one language, so for traveling players, you can have a plot or argument which explains to people who speak a different language what they're doing. One is that they become souvenirs that you can take home, and that both recall the performance and create in your mind what the performance was. Because often those things are you can't always hear things in the theatre. So it's also useful to have that kind of summary. We also go on having them over time. That particular one I showed you, The Plot of England's Joy, is a particularly amusing one. The reason why it survives is almost certainly this, that England's Joy, it became famous. It was widely advertised, and we can tell this isn't the advert, because what the advertisements say, we have all sorts of stories about it. And what the advertisement said was that there'd be a play put on for one day only at the Swan Theatre, and that it would have gentlemen and gentlewomen acting in it, and fireworks and various other things. But everyone was quite excited by these posh people performing and by women performing. And so they all flocked to the theatre to see England's Joy, which had been advertised by this man, Venor, who was the writer of England's Joy. And everyone flocked to the theatre, and clearly they were given these plot summaries in the theatre, given or sold those plot summaries, which, as I say, have different information. They don't talk about the women or those things, but they talk in great detail about what you'll see scene by scene. So everyone waited around in the theatre, and they waited and waited, and nothing happened. And it took them quite a long time to realise that Venor had ridden away with all their money, because there never was a play called England's Joy. And after that, the phrase England's Joy became a phrase for duping people. So I think that's why the plot survives, because it's a kind of notorious thing. And indeed, there is no particular reason you shouldn't hang that round as an advert. It's got quite a lot of information. But in that instance, that doesn't appear to be what the advert said. And also, more importantly, this is a special one-performance-only gift for the people who have gone to the theatre. Whereas playbills are kind of public, plots and arguments are special things because you went to the theatre. As I say, a bit like programmes today. If you want to know more about them, I've written a chapter on them in my book, Documents of Performance, which also has a chapter on playbills. So, yep. Yeah.
Hello. Oh, yes. Laura Swarfield. Yes. Have you got a date for that final playbill? Because if theatre was banned by then, I'm a bit surprised anybody got away with doing puppet plays, let alone advertising them.
Yes, it is fascinating. That bill, well, some people say it's 1650s and some people say it's 1670s. It is hard to date these things because they don't have dates on them. But either way, Bartholomew Fair and Southwark Fair went on throughout the interregnum, and we have quite a few other adverts for puppet plays over that period, and complaints from actors that are sort of, why can the puppets get away with it, but we can't. But I think what actually happened as a result was that puppet theatre, we often say we had a complete break, our theatre stopped, and then it had to start again in the restoration. But actually, the puppets kept going with all that stuff, weirdly repositioned in puppet form. And it's something that very few people have written, well, really no one's written about. And I'm just starting a project on fairgrounds in early modern England, and one of the weird things is quite how much theatre repositioned the fairground was able to retain. And I think one reason for this is that adult actors and adult plays have to be censored, but puppet plays aren't written down, so they cannot be censored, and that's how puppets are able to get away with retaining things, because all you can approve or not approve is a puppeteer. You can approve a person, but not the things. And that's why they became a very, very strange repository. But as I say, that bill, we've got other adverts from the period for the late Lancashire Witches, amongst other plays, and that obviously is involved there. And these are all early modern plays, which is another reason for thinking that this is from before there were later plays. It would be weird in the 1670s not to have some reference to plays that were later. But people are also confused by that playbill, which is in the Houghton Library in Harvard, that it has been variously dated to 1650 and 1670 for the same random reasons that I'm telling you now. Studying types might help reveal who the printer is, and that might help to date it. But otherwise, you're stuck with what it says, It also depends when people think that Punchinello made his way to England. He's a very early Punchinello for 1650. here's a less surprising Punchinello if it's 1670. So I'm sorry I can't give you an exact answer, but certainly those plays went on being performed throughout the interregnum in puppet form. I think there was a question over here.
Judith Rayburn. Going back to the printing of handbills, could you tell me what it was that restricted the printing to just one printer? Was it some sort of royal charter or a purchase privilege?
Yes, it's a privilege recorded in the stationer's register. And it's actually, at the time, as they're still working things out, it's the stationer's company think they have the right to say what stationers can print what kind of things. So that's a right that's recorded in the stationer's company, and maybe you've paid to have that right. Now, in the 1620s, the king reckons he has the right, and the king actually, in the 1620s, tried removing all rights to print on one side of paper to his favourite stationer and take them away from everyone else. And then all the printers who printed things on one side of paper, the playbill printers, the proclamation printers, and all the others, had a huge protest, which, as you can imagine, took place in one-sided bits of angry paper being posted everywhere. And the king retracted, and it went back to the stationer's company. So at that time, as I say, they're still working out who owns what. The stationers think they own the rights. The king thought maybe he owned the rights, but actually the stationers won. So that's the story with that.
Another one? We've got time for a couple more, I think. Did you have? Nope.
I'm happy to call it a day if that's the end.
Can I start? Yeah, let's finish in a minute. One of the things we were drawing attention to in this project was something you mentioned at the very beginning, which was how tiny London was at this time. And the fact is that all these walks, of all the sites we're talking about, visiting on the walks, are all within 2 miles radius of St. Paul's, because the West End didn't exist then, let alone this sort of area. Just to ask you again, I know you've run through this a few times, but the places where posts were, yeah. I mean, what kinds of posts were there more? Presumably there were more gates then, I would have thought.
There were gates, there were door posts, there were tethering posts for horses, there were pissing posts for peeing, which I'm interested in early modern lavatories, and we were talking earlier, I was saying that there are a lot of questions about how and where did people go to the loo in theatres? And no one has really looked that much into pissing posts, which at least give you a place where you can do one kind of thing if you're a guy. But I suspect there were also posts like the big round French posts that were actually posts for advertisements. I suspect that as I say, we get our noun poster from the habit of finding those things on posts. So as well as, I think, generally sticking them on any post you see, I also think there was so much information that needed to be conveyed on paper with all those many different kinds of advertisements for all sorts of different things, that actually I think there were, in fact, in the most obvious places, posts on which you can stick them. And that said, the logic for having such a post would be, for instance, if you don't want stuff stuck all over your church, then put a post outside the church so it will be stuck there instead. You know, actually you can protect the pristine nature of a building you cherish and make sure it's not lowered by adverts, by giving people a place on which to put their adverts. But what we hear from all that material about the many posts of London and can't you see that information, it's on the posts, you do get a sense that London was kind of plastered with writing. And I'm always keen to mention that just because people assume that the history of advertising doesn't particularly go back to then, and it so clearly does.
Thanks very much. Oh, one more.
Michael Holden, just wanted to ask you, in your text you referred to nails for the leafleting of the flyers, and there are references to people taking these items home. Do you think they were nailed up in bunches so that they could literally be torn off like flyers are put in boxes today?
I think that's a very interesting idea. It would make sense. It would make sense if you have a lot of flyers in one obvious place. And I wonder about that. It would make sense, particularly as if someone pulls it off, there's still another one there, so that space now goes on advertising the play. The one thing I can't work out, but as I say, it's maybe because I'm a bit interested in lavatories at present, is why someone doesn't take them all away for loo paper, you know. But I suspect that that's the case. What I actually think, there seems to be information in here about longer bills and shorter bills, and I suspect there are big wordy ones that are large and maybe pasted down, and shorter flyer-like ones that are nailed up for removal, and it would make sense to have several there. And also, maybe that's what you'd do if you really have printed 1,000 bills, you can kind of put 20 in each place. Yes, so I suspect so, but I don't know, but I suspect so.
You've just reminded me I need to take a whole bunch of these trifolds down to Shakespeare's Globe, where they haven't got any, I understand. Thanks very much, Tiffany. I think it's a marvellous talk today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing you all next time. Thanks.